Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Hybrid Jazz is a vision of all that is jazz, both traditional and contemporary, domestic and global. Here's your host, Trish Hennessy.
It is always a pleasure when I get to hear Dave Solomon do that introduction. He might not like it that I mention him by name. He's a pretty private guy, but he's got one of the best voices in the business. Ladies and gentlemen, sisters, friends, brothers, let me tell you something about today. I am so psyched for so many reasons. I'll get through it. I'm pumped more than I have ever been, especially since Mr. Daoud Saeed here has made a custom bed for me for the show. I'm really excited about that. Excited about the mix of music because it's going to be a little different than what you have heard on the show, and it's inspired by our guest in the next hour, Jen Kuramoto from Hiroshima. I'm so proud to be giving you this gentleman in town for a series of important dates and some good news to share. But his vision of what Hiroshima is made me the decisive person to figure out, guess what? This is why I call the show Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. So tickled. Let's do it, shall we? We're going to start off with something really sweet. We like to make sure you know back in the day what was hot and happening. Can't think of a better person to do it than the next gentleman. This is Donald Byrd on the trail from the 1966 CD called Mustang. Thank you.
Find another one like me.
Wow. Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy rolls on, and what a roll on that was. Marvin Sewell on a guitar there. Silver Pony, the name of the CD, recorded live. Cassandra Wilson. Oh, my gracious. That was a public domain song. Went down to St. James Infirmary. There is a YouTube video that you should catch because she's just so smoking. The cool thing about Cassandra is that she knows that the guys in her band get her, so she just gives them room to move, and it makes for a very comfortable scenario. Shoo! This whole CD is live and kicking, and so will Cassandra be. Jazz at Lincoln Center on the 30th of September through October the 1st at the Rose Theater. Been a Blue Note artist since 92. The award-winning Cassandra Wilson from something that she did just last year. Jeff Golub we heard from too. Nikki's Walk from Blues for You from 2009. This is his eighth CD that's a solo effort. Of course, Jeff plays with everybody and his mama. And these days, we're really happy to see that because Jeff, if you don't know this, has had a situation develop with first his one eye and then the second. So that has rendered him blind. And there are a myriad of efforts going on to relieve the family of the unbelievable burden of having these kinds of procedures done to see if they can indeed restore his eyesight. Can you imagine? Jeff Golub is one of the coolest guys on the planet with one of the sunniest dispositions. He's going to be at Rehoboth Beach Jazz the 12th through the 16th of October. I know that I'll be celebrating my birthday just so I can make sure I support Jeff Golub. If you want to know how you can help the cause and see if anything you can do, even the least amount of a dollar, two, three, whatever you can do, go to Jeff Golub, GOLUB.com, and there is a Help for Jeff Golub charityauctionstoday.com site that you can go to, and a myriad of ways that you can do your thing in helping. He's also going to be, by the way, at Sedona Jazz on the Rocks on the 8th of October, which is going to be a gorgeous affair. Donald Byrd to start our wonderful set. Oh, it was so cool. Born on December the 9th, 1932, so Donald Byrd is going to be 79 this year. You may not know this. I just did some research. I love doing this. You know probably just a multitude of albums as leader, as sideman, performed with Lionel Hampton before finishing his master's at the Manhattan School of Music, replaced Clifford Brown in Art Blakey's Jazz Messengers, played with post-Blakey Coltrane, Sonny Rollins, Monk, Herbie Hancock, 1973, The Blackbirds, Walkin' in Rhythm. You surely know about that. What You Heard is on the Trail from 1966. After that time and before that time, Donald Byrd was busy. Can I just say? He's got two masters from Columbia University. In 1976, got his law degree, got a doctorate at the Columbia University Teachers College, and is artist in residence since 2009 at Delaware State University. Wow! And folks say that they can't get up in the morning because life is too hard. Let me tell you something about Donald Byrd. He got up and did it every day. Amazing, amazing kind of life that he's had. Maybe someday, somehow, we'll get a chance to talk to him. Trish Hennessy here with you, awaiting the arrival of Dan Kuramoto from Hiroshima. What a thrill it is to have someone who is such a visionary, such a peacemonger in this world of stress and disagreement, trying to build bridges wherever he goes musically, having formed Hiroshima in 1974. Just wonderful to know that he will be here with us. Let's move along to some music, shall we? This is Conquero, Pancho Sanchez and his Latin jazz band. This is Short Dog from the CD Do It on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy.
Sabiendo que la rosa muere triste y se toca.
Oh, mercy. It's just so cool to be able to play something like that for you. Sometimes I actually walk around the house pretending I am Lucia Pulido, or Lucia, if you like the softer C, and pretend I'm singing that song, Carmelita, Adios. Woohoo! If you go to luciapulido.com, you will find out some things about this beautiful and sensual woman who is a guitarist and singer of Latin American folk songs, particularly Colombian. She does these hurting and harvest songs, these funeral laments, the strong voice of Latin America. It's just a trip. So busy, too. She has a New York-based quartet and or trio. She also does Latin American traditional music with an Argentinian guitarist. And she does work with Brazilian pianist Benjamin Topkin, who put together this great group of folks from, like, what, 7 Latin American countries. And they called their project Contemporary America, Another Center. And that's where you'll be able to hear Carmelita, Adios. Just love that. We heard some glorious sounds, mercy, Mongo Santa Maria, from his Mongo's Way CD back in 1971. Saoko. I had to ask my friend Dave how to pronounce that. Mongo Santa Maria, much can be said, extremely influential. Afro-Cuban Latin jazz percussionist and band leader who composed the beloved Coltrane song Afro Blue. He was born in 1917 in Havana, died in 2003. Very interesting story, besides the fact that he was integral in fusing Afro-Cuban sounds and rhythms of R&B to make that boogaloo sound that was big back in the 60s. I remember that. I'm raising my hand. This is a cool story. In 1962, there was a bad night at a Cuban nightery in the Bronx area of New York, and there was only a couple of people there. So they thought, okay, what are we going to do? Hey, let's get this guy, our regular guy is in here, let's get this guy Herbie to sit in on keys. It's Herbie Hancock. So Herbie asked if he could do his song that he had just written called Watermelon Man. Oh, mercy. So they did it because what the heck? And they were just free form. Everybody was having a good time, caution to the wind. Well, somebody heard it and said, look, could I just rush you into the studio and record that? Well, don't you know that became so huge for Mongo Santa Maria that I'm sure that Herbie laughs at that story still. We heard also from Conquero, conga player, band leader, Pancho Sanchez, who did Short Dog from Do It, his 22nd recording from Concord Picante. And you talk about a life. Pancho is still with us. He's going to be 60 years old, October 30th. We're real tickled about that. Latin jazz, swing, bebop, salsa, all involved in that voice and in what he does, a succulent hybrid stew, if you will, on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Interesting story there, too. In 1975, a younger Pancho Sanchez went up to his idol, Cal Jader, and asked if he could sing a song. And Cal said, sure, and was so taken with him, he kept him for a week and then asked him to join the band. And Pancho was with Cal until Cal passed away in 1982. So Pancho has been doing his thing ever since. Do It. Oh, that CD, by the way, features Tower of Power on 2 tracks. So if you want to pick that up, you might want to not only enjoy Short Dog, but the other tracks as well. We have Dan Karamoto with us from Hiroshima coming up at the top of the hour, and we're going to play a couple of more songs so you can get into the flavor of the groove that we have here today. David Dyson, we just had him on Cool Jazz Conversations, and we, Joy Hall and I, enjoyed him so much. He's D.C.-based, originally born in the Dakotas, but just so well known as one of the consummate bass players, not only in this region, but far beyond, has played with some amazing people. I wanted to play this song from his Unleashed CD from 2008, Southern Fried Go-Go, because Go-Go is real well known in D.C. Thank you, Chuck Brown. But I want to play it because there's a harmonica player named Frédéric Yonnet on this particular track. Frédéric will be with us on Thursday on the show, and what a story he has to tell. Oh my, you're going to hear some sounds that are going to thrill you, and to know that he's played with, are you ready? Erykah Badu, Prince, and Stevie Wonder. Just, you know, second stringers. He's going to be with us because he has a big gig in Philly that he's going to talk about. But first, David Dyson on bass with his superior musicians from Unleashed. This is Southern Fried Go-Go on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Check it out. Thank you. is Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Oh, my gracious. That is just so beautiful. Oh, such a pleasure to be able to give you exquisite music like that. That, by the way, is Winds of Change from Legacy by Hiroshima. And the whole story of how Legacy came to be is a story unto itself. Actually, an hour is really not enough to give you, as far as Hiroshima is concerned. Suffice to say that the first time around for Winds of Change, that song was nominated for a Grammy back in 1980, but it was retooled, revitalized, reborn. And to tell you all about it right now on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy is a very special guest, Dan Kuramoto. How are you, sir?
Hello. How are you?
I am so much better now to have you here. I was a nervous wreck for most of the day, but now that you're here, I am absolutely calm. What can I say about you? What would you like to say about yourself?
I'm so glad that we connected because I wasn't even sure that we were online together. I had called the number and pressed one, and I had waited for about 10 minutes, and then nothing happened, so I sort of I called your landline. So this is great.
Oh,
how are you?
I'm great.
York right now.
Yes, you are, and you're there for a couple of different reasons, and we'll get to all of that. I'm so sorry that you were holding for 10 minutes, though. Oh, my gosh, Dan.
Oh, that's okay. That's we were at a Cuban restaurant, Guantanamera, that was recommended to us by a former percussionist, our band, Luis Conti, who was playing with us, and we're in New York, and he got a call from Madonna, and he said, "Well, gee, I don't know, musically, Madonna is cool, but not, he loves doing what we do." But I said, "But you have a family with three kids, and Madonna can pay you a small fortune each week, so you should go and do that." Now he's a percussionist on Dancing with the Stars.
No kidding. Oh, my gosh. Isn't that an interesting story? Wow.
He's a Cuban national that's been in this country. He was one of the founding members of probably the best Latin fusion group called Caldera.
Oh, yeah, okay.
In the 80s. And one of the other founding members was Dean Cortez, who is also our bass player today, all these years. So
we have a multicultural
connection.
And see, that's what you are all about. I'm so wondrous of your career. You inspired me to do the music for today's show because what was it about you back in the 70s that made you decide that you wanted to explore the multicultural aspect of your music with at the core of it? And I love what the interviewer said. You did an interview with visualizeasian.com, and the person interviewing you said that you have a core of Japanese-ness, which I love that word. What was it that made you decide you had this vision? Tell me about this vision you had so long ago, Dan.
Well, fundamentally, it was that though the band has never been all Asian, let alone all Japanese, we have at our root a kind of Japanese-American sensibility. And that is to say, like, I'm one of the founders of the band, and I'm a third-generation Japanese-American, which means my grandfather came here around the turn of the century, and he was a cowboy and then a farmer, and then he actually ended up owning and running a small hotel in Japantown in Los Angeles. And then my father was then, of course, born in L.A., and he was an all-city football and baseball player. And
wow.
Unfortunately, he and all of our people were in prison during World War II, only for being Japanese. So an entire population of this country was held prisoner for racial reasons.
Oh,
now,
yes.
It wasn't that there wasn't a war going on at the time. In Japan was, you know, at that time one of the Axis powers, but it's just a little ironic that no Italians were put in prison or no Germans were put in prison, just Japanese.
Right.
And I bring that up only to say that, you know, it gives us a frame of reference in terms of, you know, sometimes you need to explain yourself. We want people to connect to us. And growing up in Southern California, it was so available the different cultures. And so we thought that maybe it would be good to have a voice from a Japanese-American perspective. And so the majority of the band was Japanese-American. But being Japanese-American, in and of itself is a multicultural posture. And mm-hmm. so we, as I said, we've never even had an all-Asian band. And the reason the band is called Hiroshima is really because we're children of that post-nuclear era in terms
yes.
of, all that madness. And we thought that, part of our cultural heritage from going back to Japan would be, that Japan was the victim of that. And that we need them to kind of raise a voice for humanity and for peace worldwide. And we thought we could do that by bonding cultures, by making people aware of how different we are, and that difference gives us richness. And that's what we think specifically is so amazing about being American and why we're so proud, because we're here, we can embrace all the different cultures. And we thought if we could do it in a musical way and include things Japanese, then that would enlarge our voice and create an art and culture component to, our experience and hopefully the experience of our children and succeeding generations. And so we thought, cool, now how do we do it? it was just a kind of an amazing thing that we're playing at a kind of community arts picnic in Los Angeles. And I heard this unbelievable woman, young girl, gorgeous, playing an instrument called koto, K-O-T-O. It's a Japanese harp. And I was playing at, I was an art school student, and I graduated in painting and drawing, but I was in an art school band. And my whole notion of it is that I didn't want to be in an art school band and necessarily always play top 40 music. So we started writing our own music. So we're this sort of eccentric art school band performing at this all day long event. And I heard this beautiful woman playing this amazing instrument, but at a level of skill that I had not heard in this country. I was completely blown away. Well, a few weeks later, I come to find out that she's one of my best friend's sister.
Oh,
and
wow.
So we just met, and because she was curious about the band that I was in, because we're doing so much experimental music. I suppose at that time it was called jazz rock, I don't know what it was, but we had electric flutes and things like that, and we're just a bunch of art school kids, and she thought she wanted to find a way to take this beautiful instrument and somehow make it part of the American musical landscape, and she thought that someone as eccentric as myself might be the kind of person that would see it as something exciting and probable. And
unbelievable.
And so we sort of just started getting together, and I knew nothing of Japanese music. I mean, my grandparents lived upstairs. They played it all day long, but I was much more into two big influences. I was into, the pop rock music of the day, whether it was Elvis Presley or whoever else it was. And my older brother, who was an aspiring jazz piano player. So every day I heard my brother playing jazz piano, and my parents loved Sinatra and stuff like that, but then, and I sort of loved, the rock and roll and Elvis and the Beatles and stuff, and then my grandparents playing Japanese music all day long. And then I was living in East L.A. I was born and raised in East L.A., which is the largest Hispanic community outside of Mexico City. And where I lived, there were three dance halls within a block. So all night long, I would hear live music from the dance halls. And, and when you're 8 and 9 years old, you didn't really know who Tito Puente was.
Right.
But I was growing up listening to all these different musics 24/7. I mean, I'd lay in bed, and I'd hear, the salsa coming from the dance halls. And then I wake up in the morning and I hear the Japanese music and my grandparents were playing upstairs. And I hear my brother practicing jazz piano. And then meanwhile, if I could come near the record player, I'd play what I wanted to listen to. And my folks would, you know, they love Sinatra and Tony Bennett and all this stuff. And so it became a part of my host's musical sensibility. I mean, all of it, and all of it kind of all at once. So I didn't really differentiate. I just, you know, that which was good and emotionally moved me,
right,
that was music. And it, categories kind of didn't really, I didn't get categories, right? Because, you know, either it was cool or it wasn't. And then meeting June, then the world of Japanese open music opened up to me in an entirely different way. And she was very curious about, you know, there's a real hierarchical sensibility in Japan about passing, you know, information along. And she comes from the lineage of the Miyagi Kai. Kai means school. And Miyagi, Michio Miyagi, is the most famous historically of the Japanese koto players. And his school is the most famous, and his compositions are world famous. He wrote a song called Haru no Umi, which is worldwide one of the 10 most popular compositions ever written in the
world. Oh, my.
Yeah, and anyway, so she comes from that lineage. And if I can backpedal a little bit, if I'm not taking too much time.
Oh, please, talk away. I love it.
The koto is originally an instrument from China, and where it's called the shen. And it didn't have bridges. It was played all on harmonics, and it had, I think, 18 strings. And then it migrated ultimately to Korea, where it was played with metal strings, and then they added bridges to it. And by the time it came to Japan, which is many, many, many years later, which is, you know, but by Japanese standards, you know, kind of more recent, that was like about between 600 to 800 AD, you know, and because it was 600 BC in China. So that instrument, it's about 6 feet long, about 18 inches wide. It is, the wood is called kiri. There's a word for it in English. What is it? I'm not sure. But that particular wood is grows abundantly in the Carolinas. But it's a different kind of kiri that's in Japan. And it's almost soft wood. You could press it with your fingernail and make a dent. And that is part of the richness of the sound. The instrument is carved from a whole trunk of a tree.
And
it's whittled down to the shape that is, and it's fundamentally in the shape of a dragon, which means long life, right? And
yes.
And it has 13 strings with 13 movable bridges, and 13 because there are 13 moons in a year.
Oh, my.
There's a full moon every month. You should have known that there are 13 moons in a year, and I didn't know that. So anyway, and it's fundamentally played with a pentatonic scale, and it was the emperor's court instrument. So commoners in Japan never heard the instrument until almost the 13th century, and actually it was liberated in the 12th century when the first, and that was the first time in Japan that there was an empress, that there was actually a woman who ran Japan. Instead of an emperor, there's the empress in the 12th century. So she sort of liberated the instrument. And anyway, so then moving forward to Michio Miyagi, who, you know, early in the 20th century, you know, and most of the, ironically, most of the great koto players were blind men.
Really?
Michio Miyagi, most of his compositions were based on sounds of nature, and being unsighted, you know, he would often sit, you know, for months at a time, trying to, like, study the sounds of nature, the wind, birds, and so on and so forth. And then he created techniques on the koto that emulated those sounds. So, like, chidori is based on birds, and so on and so forth. Haru no Ume is based on the ocean. And it's a song that sometimes June and I do in duet with the koto and flute. You know,
oh, that's beautiful.
But, so, Michio Miyagi, the most famous of all koto players, had a protege, and that was this woman, Kazuo Kudo. And Kudo's sensei, or teacher, Kudo, was Japan's most famous koto player. But for reasons that, you know, are personal and I would never raise, she chose to move to the United States. And when she moved to the United States,
she found June.
Born in, when June was born in Japan, and she and her brothers and sisters and mother came to the United States at the age of six because June's father was a Japanese national. No, I mean, excuse me, a United States national who was in Japan because he was bilingual, and he ran hotels, American military hotels in Japan. And then the war broke out, World War II. And so then they tried to draft him into the Japanese army, but he was an American citizen. So he said, there's no way I'm joining the Japanese army. But he couldn't get back to America because he was too well known in Japan.
So he
spent the entire World War II. We're actually trying to put together a script for this because it's an unbelievable true story. In China, pretty much, escaping the Japanese military police because he was bilingual, they wanted him to be in the Japanese army so
yes.
he could translate American things. But,
oh,
I mean,
so they essentially wanted him to be a spy.
His father was an amazing American baseball player. He played on a Japanese-American All-Star team. He knew Lou Gehrig. there are pictures with him and Lou Gehrig. Because her father was an undefeated American middleweight boxer, 18 pro fights, 17 knockouts. I mean,
get out!
Really amazing guy, yeah. But he's in Japan, and so he spent the entire war kind of, he did one of those things where you take a train and you switch train and go the other way and to evade the Japanese military police, and literally. So the one day he switched trains was the day that he was on his way to Hiroshima the day the bomb fell. And he did
a train trip and
went the other way, and then an hour later the bomb fell in Hiroshima.
Oh, Dan, what a story this is.
I know. That's what we're thinking. We've got to make a movie about this. It's just amazing.
You really do, because that would inspire and encourage, empower, and make also people aware of what transpired back then. That's a beautiful movie scenario.
Yeah, I mean, he kept trying to explain to everybody, I look Japanese, but I'm an American. You know, and the only reason, like, when he's in China, And then the Chinese thought he was a Japanese spy, but then there were some Americans that were in China, and they started talking to him, and they said, this guy knows way too much about American baseball to be from the U.S.
Oh, wow.
You know? Anyway, so I know I'm just rambling on, but, so this is the scenario. So then June is born in Japan. And he is, after the war, then he moves back to Japan, and the American military reclaims him because they need his help in Tokyo because he's bilingual, and so he started running an officers' club. So he sent the family, though, back to the United States. So June was 6 years old. She was disillusioned because she knew nothing of the United States.
Yeah.
She didn't speak any English. And so it was a really tremendous culture shock for her. And her first year here, they had these things for immigrants, and they had an entertainment evening, and there was this woman who played the koto, and her name was Kazuo Kudo, the protege of Michio Miyagi.
Yes.
And you not being able to speak English, being in the United States, feeling so lost, just told her mother, this is what I want to do. This is what I want to do, what this woman is doing. And because they gave her a tie back to Japan, and she said in one moment she fell in love with it forever.
That's amazing.
And the irony, her mother, and they were very poor. She was a pattern seamstress. So when a famous clothier would do a design, she would make the first pattern. You know, so that's what June's mother did. She talks to this woman. And they didn't have that much money. So in exchange for being able to teach out of June's mother's house, she got three koto lessons. And that's the art of a six-year-old kid to becoming the world's most famous koto player began. And everything she identified was with that instrument. And growing up in L.A., she knew no one would understand it, so she never even told anybody that she played Toto.
No, really?
And yeah, until one year in junior high school, they had a talent show, and she carried walking with a koto for almost 2 miles to school and played it. And then people made fun of her. And they weird and creepy. And so, you know, and so she carried it home, and she never told anyone, but she played every day. And she became Kazue Kudo's protege. So this lineage, the world's greatest koto player, fell on June. And it's a very ironic situation, because then in Japan, June is both revered, and at the same time, you know, there's a great degree of hostility toward her.
Really? Why?
Because in a Japanese sensibility, she was born in Japan, and she is recognized as, you know, this extraordinary koto player. Then why isn't she back in Japan?
I understand. Yeah.
And she said, "But no, but my life is here.
Right.
I'm an American." And so all of this really motivated her to find a way to have a voice with that instrument in this country.
Mm.
You know, and so when we met, she had all of that history inside of her. And it's extraordinary. So, and we fell in love. We got married. We got divorced. And we remain best friends to this day. But there's, and you know, and maybe it's an American phenomenon, but 24/7 is rough, you know. And so
yes,
you know, but we found a place where we're comfortable. We see each other every day. We almost have a meal together every single day. Yeah, you know, but we just gravitated to a slightly different place, you know, because our family became the music itself, along with our daughter. But you know, it became all of it, and that's why, you know, we regard all of our albums like our children. I know it seems kind of weird, but you know, they capture, you know, real aspects of our lives, and in our own way, we tell very personal stories about, you know, different points in our life. Like on our album, Go, which
1987.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah, right. We wrote a song about Why Can't I Love You, which is the disconnect between people who truly love each other but have a problem communicating with each other. And if people really listen to the lyrics, you know, it tells our story, but it's the story of so many Americans, you know. And it also tells a story about from generation to generation why we don't easily embrace generations. And so our music is embedded in a lot of those kinds of stories. And people say, well, you know, it's really hard to do, especially if it's instrumental. But for us, maybe it's more easily done instrumental because, you know, music is about the feeling. And words often don't communicate the whole story, as we all know. You know,
oh, yes. Oh, instrumentally, Dan, because people can embrace from all over the world, it becomes personal for them if there are no words to get in the way.
Right. And all, you know, but, you know, so much of communication is a glance. You know, there are so many ways to communicate, but we chose the medium of music. And so then going back to that picnic and us meeting each other, and then it was this whole process then of, well, how does this work? Because no one's ever tried to make the koto work in these very music settings. I mean, there were a few, and so we spent a lot of time studying those few that did. And there was a great American jazz harpist, Dorothy Ashby, who actually did an instrumental album on koto, and that was really a revelation. But June took all of that and she combined it with, you know, all her years of classical study. And she has all her degrees, her professional degree from the Miyagi School in Japan for classical koto. So she tries to keep intact, you know, the idiomatic styles of classical Japanese music in all the different settings that we play in, you know, which run obviously from jazz to pop to R&B to Latin, And because that's the American experience. I mean, it's
yes.
like I just ran back to my hotel 20 blocks so I wouldn't be late for the interview because I was eating at a Cuban restaurant.
What?
You know, because our band is a well-known foodie band. I've been on the Food Network just to talk about food in different cities because as we tour around, you know, over the last 30 years, you know, people from other bands at other chefs have called me up. They go, well, let's see, if I'm in Austin, where can I get really authentic Mexican food? You know, and
right.
then I tell them, there's a place called Los Barrios and so on and so forth. So pretty much from, you know, like if you're in Cape Town, where would you get good Portuguese seafood? There's a place on the wharf with a yellow awning that is just unbelievable and so on and so forth. You know, where would you go in Tokyo to get this or what? You know, so and Montreal for that, or Chicago for and we keep along, and we have been often kind of blamed for basing our tours around where we know great restaurants are. You know, where
no
to
kidding.
Fly
well, yeah, so. Well, you're in luck this week because you're going to be in New York and you're going to be in Maryland. So, woohoo! That's
right.
pretty good stuff.
Yeah. I know Maryland crab cakes. I mean, it's just.
Right.
You know, there are several places that we like to go for crab cakes, but and of course the Blue Points. But our whole thing is in that way. It's culture and it's art, and embraces many things beyond food. And we try to encompass all of those things in a musical setting. And we're just so blessed that you know we have a band, because if one thinks about it. There are a precious few bands left anymore at all.
Amen.
You know, and our band, Danny Yamamoto, our drummer, has been with us from the very beginning. And he's
That's
a Japanese-American. His dad was a long-haul truck driver who just passed away a few months ago, along with my dad.
Bless your heart.
Thank you.
So sorry.
And they're inspirational men, both of them. My dad used to build race cars. So he, in high school, I don't know how familiar your audience is with mainstream jazz, but in high school,
yeah.
he was the drummer in the Billy Childs Trio.
Get out of here. Whoa, that is some sort of pedigree.
And the bass player was Larry Klein, who, for those of you who may know Joni Mitchell, was is a great bass player and producer and was Joni's husband for many years. And like Joni, June and I, Joni and Larry, they're best friends.
Isn't that something?
Larry still helps Joni do her music and produces, and they hang out all the time, just like me and June. But that's not an unfamiliar story in music. You know, Fleetwood Mac, I mean, you know, on and on. There are couples that still play together every day. But in any case, so, you know, moving forward with the whole notion of all of these things. So there's Danny, and then, so he comes from this amazing jazz background. I mean, he's playing with Billy Childs. He's 16 years old. He's playing with Billy Childs.
Crazy.
You know what I mean? Yeah, I mean, and he's played with all, and the whole L.A. scene, he's played with all the great jazz cats. And he was doing that when he was in high school, you know, trying to take his drums on the bus. our bass player, Dean Cortez, he was born in Miami, grew up in L.A. He actually was playing with Boss Gags when he was 18 years old. He did the Lowdown Tour. He was the bass player through the whole Lowdown era.
I remember that well. I remember a whole lot well because I'm not sure of your age, but I might be maybe a little older than you because I remember all those scenes from back in the 60s and the late 50s, too.
That's where I grew up. And he grew up with the Picaro brothers, with Jeff and Steve and all those guys. So all of us were part of this larger circle of L.A. area musicians. And all of us were into, like, man, you know, what's the next thing that we could do that no one else has done?
Right.
And I was the only one with really very little musical background. You know, I played on the drum line, you know, as a kid. And then I went to San Francisco. I was going to art school. I was kind of traveling around, getting away with going to college on tennis scholarships. because I was a middling decent tennis player, so I was able to go to school for free on sports scholarships. And then I'm in art school at Cal State Long Beach, and I decided I'm going to go to art school. And then my brother, who ended up being tour manager for the Jacksons and for Heart and the Beach Boys and Boston and stuff, he we're in art school, and he was like, you know, like, you play music, you meet women. And I'm going like, good idea. So, but I'm not playing the drums anymore because I did it for a while. Well, when I was going to school in San Francisco, come with, you're the first one that last one to leave. So, you know, like, this is not going to work out because most women aren't, and they all leave with the guitar player, right? Because they pack and they're gone, right? So I thought, if I'm going to do anything, I'm going to do something like, so I'm the first one to leave. So I pick up the flute. I mean, like, you know, it's a little tiny case and you're gone, right?
Right.
So, I mean, you know, I'm telling stories I've never told. Look what you're doing to me, Trish.
But, I love it. I love it. Talk on, my brother.
So it evolved from that sensibility. So, but because of that, I have no rules about music or art. And so I started to try to put together some eclectic, a group of, with Danny and June, you know, a great jazz drummer, the world's greatest coca player, and myself. I tried to put together a group of people that could relate to a concept. And we organized this band on three principles. Gee, I've never told this story either. One was that more than anything else, that we could become a community of friends. Because you're in such a volatile industry that, you know, even if you do well, there's going to be horrible bumps along the way. So
yes.
We couldn't relate to each other as human beings in the first place. It's madness to try and go through, you know, such a tough journey. Secondly, you know, that they related to the concept of no rules. That we were going to try to embrace, first of all, Japanese music into Western jazz and R&B and pop, which no one had ever tried.
Right.
And that we weren't going to do it as a Japanese idiom, but we were going to do it as an American idiom. Do you know what I'm saying? I mean,
it's very exciting because the consistent is that there were no rules, so it gave you freedom all the time.
Right, which to us is an American sensibility.
Yes.
You know, yeah, you know, the willingness, it's like I'm a third-generation Japanese-American musician who just ran down from a Cuban restaurant for lunch, you know. You see what I'm saying? Hey, you know, that's an American experience, you know what I mean? We wanted that to be inherent in the heart and soul of the band. And so... And Dean Cortez, who played on our very first record, the very first track on our very first record, is a song called Lion Dance. And I knew Dean. We used to jam together and stuff. And Dean was on a world tour with Bob Skaggs. He was in LA for a week. I said, Dean, come down and play on one track. So he came and played on that. And then, you know, subsequent to that, he was in Caldera, which I mentioned earlier with Luis Conti and Jorge Strunz and Carlos Vega, and I mean, just the most extraordinary group of musicians. And Dean's played on over 300 movies and albums. And he came back to the band because, he said, it's one place where you play everything you know in one show. He said, you've got to have everything with you because, you know, we'll go through so many different kinds of things. And I was very insistent that everything be authentic. So if we get a merengue, or whatever style of music, that everybody had to really, if we do something that's implied Indian, if we do something clearly Japanese, or whatever it is, that, you know, we don't just cop it, you know, we become it for a while. We study it, you know, and so there's
you become immersed in it. It's an immersion.
Totally. Right,
yeah.
Because otherwise I think it's almost, it's almost like mocking it, you know, not by intention, but if you don't really invest in it enough, you give it the respect to know what it really feels like.
That's another,
because, as I mentioned, so that's point two, that everyone relates to the band, and point three is that they can play. Because I don't know that, you know, having chops is nearly as important as having meaning. If you really mean something, if something really connects with you, you'll find a way.
That's right. Again, this has been discussed so much. You can be technically perfect, but if it doesn't have the ring of truth, it means nothing.
Trish, thank you. And you said it so well. Can I use that later?
Please.
Because no, that's exactly that's what this band is all about. And so then as we got to and Kimo Cornwell, the gigantic monster piano player from Hawaii, and he came to the mainland and moved to Los Angeles right around when we were doing our second album. And he was at that time playing with Gloria Lynn and Ronnie Laws, and then he did a long stint with Al Jarreau. And then with probably one of the great R&B bands of all time, he played with Frankie Beverly and Maze for a while. And he did their live records and stuff. In fact, you know, to this day, Frankie Beverly still, when I see him, he has a standoffish thing because Kimo was in his band when Kimo came to our band. But Kimo would play with us from the early 80s on. When he wasn't on the road with the other bands, if he wasn't with Al, and Al Jarreau I've known forever, so he and Joe Sample and we all used to hang out at a little club called the Baked Potato in Hollywood.
Gracious! The Baked Potato in Hollywood.
Yeah, and I'd sit there broke, you know, because starving musician, and Joe Sample would look at me and he goes, "All right, sit down." Yeah. Pour this guy a cognac, you know, and then Al would come in and scat for a little while and sit down, and Al would go, "Hey man, you need anything? And get this guy a potato and a glass of wine." and we don't take care of each other.
That's so cool.
I mean, to this day when I see Joe Sample, he'll point at me and go, "You know, you owe me a cognac."
He does not.
because music is such a journey in that way, especially these cats. Because they all did their own thing. They didn't follow anybody else. You know, they went their own way. So they I was nowhere in their league, but they respected me because we went our own way. And so then we got Kimo, and then Kimo joined, and Kimo's one of the newer guys in the band. He's been in the band for 18 years. And then so the only new guy, who we call the young blood, is this guy Shoji Kamada, who graduated from Stanford. His parents were hippies. They lived up in the mountains. I'm not making this up.
I know you're not.
Who lived up in the mountains in Mount Shasta. And he grew up, you know, first in a tent and then in a beat-up mobile home, you know, and there were white people. In fact, his mother is now a Superior Court Judge, State of California.
Wow!
Former hippie, yeah. And his dad is a wrestling coach. But he goes to Stanford.
That is hysterical.
He spent his whole life playing Japanese drums because another hippie family that was living in Mount Shasta was a second-generation taiko, which is a large Japanese festival drum. They're a second generation taiko family. So he grew up playing taiko, thinking it's as natural it is to play trumpet or trap drum.
That is amazing. And then you came together, and here's June under her circumstances learning koto.
Right, and so Shoji, who was this young kid, you know, he's just past 30 in our band. That's a young kid who just had his first baby daughter, you know. So he comes. He's a new guy, and he's been with us now for almost 9 years. Right out of college, you know. He's played with so many people, and all of us play on movies. So you know, June and I do a lot of Hans Zimmer movies. Like we started on what was it, Black Rain, and it's the last half of Black Rain is almost all just me and June. But I've done Thin Red Line with Terrence and with Hans and the Ghost Ship and Pirates of the Caribbean, you know, that Foghorn sound. That's the only time I came to the spot. Yeah, I mean, so all of the, and Shoji played on Thin Red Line, and June, you know, so June was the lead musician on The Last Samurai, you know, the Tom Cruise movie. So,
yes.
So we're all, you know, we're running the circuit together of playing movies and so on and so forth to supplement what we do. And so Shoji brings in this whole other discipline because he has a band called Own Ensemble that is so clever and so hip, and he combines like scratching and hip hop with 1,200-year-old taiko stuff.
Oh, wow.
And you know, and sometimes you see him playing with Stevie Wonder. Sometimes, you know, so we're all doing other projects, but this is a home base thing because this is the one place, you know, that all the cats say, you know, and one show you get to play everything you know.
And also, isn't Shoji, isn't he a throat singer?
I'm sorry, what?
A throat singer, which I find so intriguing. If somebody can do throat singing.
There are, I think, about a dozen derivations of throat singing because there's African, you know, but his is Tuvan, his style, which it's the southern tip of Russia, and the northern tip of Mongolia, and it is an independent country that has never been overtaken by any country, which is impossible to imagine that Mongolia didn't overtake Tuva, and neither did Russia. But
yes.
That's how tough these people are. And it's a little tiny country. But, yeah, when he was in Japan playing taiko, you know, cause, and everyone studied all over the world in this band. So, but when he was in Japan playing taiko, he met some Cuban throat singers, and Shoji is amazing. I mean, in our show, he does a segment, you know, that's just his. And he'll just go downstage, and he'll go into this tube and throat singing, and he can sing almost 5 octaves.
And that's pretty extraordinary.
Yeah, it's almost the range of a piano. And people, the crowd, just goes psychotic because they've never heard anything. And then he walks up stage, and then he plays taiko like out of his mind. I mean, it's just amazing that the kid has got so much talent, you know, and he was Brighton to go to Stanford on full scholarship. So, you know, he's an amazing, extraordinary young talent. And we're just blessed because we're our own little community. So we...
Oh, you really are, Dan. That is... And you called it right. I'm so grateful that you understand this as a blessing for musicians to get the concept and for you to have lasted all these years, because your first album was out in 79. That is crazy. I was married then. I don't even know the guy anymore. Man.
So it's been this journey. And even to the point that even all our crew guys and all the other guys that are in a band, they can still consider this home base. There's not a crew guy I call up, and if they're available and I need them to work, not one of them has ever asked me how much they're going to get paid.
Oh, boy. That's something.
And I mean ever. You know, because this is home for a lot of musicians, like Luis Conti, one of the top percussionists in the world. He never asked me if he's even getting paid, you know, if he does a session. Because everyone considers this a home, and they know when they come here, their ideas are welcome, and they know they're going to play something they never played before, and so everybody's all in, you know. So we're really blessed because, you know, we don't own it personally; we own it collectively, you know.
And
that's
Dan,
how we look at it.
We can't stress this enough. I mean, I'll say it, and I've said it for such a long time. I called you at the top of the show when we were playing music the first hour. You are a peacemonger. You have done this for all these years, and you have created, fostered an atmosphere of peace. So when children don't get an education the way they should about living in this multicultural, wonderful world that we live in, you have brought forth music from Hiroshima, and it has been their education because they have learned about cultures through your music. They have learned about ancient music through your music. It's just amazing. I can't say enough. I'm amazed that you haven't won a Pulitzer Prize or a Nobel Peace Prize. I'm not
kidding.
You're
very kind. But it has very little to do with me, and it has everything to do with people sharing that sensibility. It's like, you know, like on our website, HiroshimaMusic.com, you know, for the first time we're asking people to join our website, because that way we can stay in contact with them, because the entire music world has changed. And if we do it right, it'll be a change for the better, because it won't be controlled by corporate thinking. We can ultimately begin to control it, you know, by the artist. And so in order to do that, we need to have an immediate dialogue with people, because even radio, who knows how much radio we're going to be able to have for people to hear us, and without record stores, you know, because I would go to a record store having no idea what I wanted and go to the store and spend a half a day there and walk out of there with some albums, and it was all a discovery. I mean, I was a kid in a candy store. I was a kid in an auditory candy store where, you know, I would discover worlds, entire worlds, you know, just by leaping through bins in a store. That doesn't exist anymore. And so we're going to ask, and we never call people who come to see us, you know, fans. We don't know what that means relative to what we do. And we spent a little bit of time thinking about it, because before we called friends, and we thought, no, we want to expand it to who we really are. So, you know, we settle on, you know, so henceforth we're the Hiroshima community. And so we're asking people to join the community, because we're going to share a lot of other things, not just about music, but about, you know, what's going on in life, and share, again, our own hit on art and culture. So I can tell you that if you go to the Guantanamera on 8th Avenue, they have one of the extraordinary chicken soups of all time. Really, really good chicken soup. You know, but, you know, you might be in New York, and you know, where would I go? You know, and we like to just, you know, since we travel, you know, most of our lives, we like to share a little bit. Yeah, you know, because that's right. That's what your mother would say. You have something to eat? Would you eat? Right. Well, in this case, like that with in the community, you know, like, it's just like, you know, it's hard to get a better, you know, even though it's over publicized, Carnegie Deli, their matzo ball soup is almost unbeatable, I think.
Stop it. Oh, I'm so hungry thinking about this. And then you're going to come to Ram's Head in Annapolis on Saturday. So every single one of those restaurants that you have around you are off the chain.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And by the way, we love Ram's Head. We love playing everywhere. But Ram's Head is so cool. They have great food there, by the way.
Oh, they do. I know. I was just going to say, oh, my gosh, because every time that I go, I get the same appetizer. It really is cool. And did you know, Dan, that just this year, Ram's Head was called the best venue for seating of a certain size, the best in the country?
Oh, I don't doubt. You know, it is amazing. And we have such great contact with the audience there, you know, because it's so intimate there that, you know, like half the time we're talking to the audience from the stage and they're talking to us, and it is the extension of the community. I mean, it feels like you're literally playing, you know, in a big living room amongst friends, and it's all about being personal. And then we're really looking forward to it because, you know, we had intended to get our new album, Departure, which is a follow-up. And I was listening to your show. You were playing things off of Legacy, which was there. We're very blessed to nominate for a Grammy for that record.
Yes.
So we're thinking, well, we're following up our latest Grammy-nominated record, and the industry has changed. You know, we need to make a new move, and then that's when we decide, well, I guess it's about a departure. So, and really, we had intended for the album to come out in May. But there were circumstances, as I mentioned, that we had some losses.
Yes.
In our families, you know, our drummer Danny, his dad, and my dad both passed in a period of 2 months.
Oh, gosh.
And we needed to like circle the wagon for a while.
Yes, of course you did.
And at the very same time, there's the horrible disaster in Japan.
Yes.
So we started and we did a small tour of just relief concerts. And we spent a fair amount of time, particularly June and I, not even playing in concerts, but helping people organize events to raise
money.
That's
wonderful.
Because, you know, there were people who wanted to do it, but they had no idea. And we said, well, here, let us help you. Let us show you how. And that way we were able to call in sound companies that were willing to, you know, help out. And even venues who waived fees and things like that to raise money. And in fact, tomorrow night here in New York, at BB King, right in Midtown, we're doing a huge Japan relief show that we're sort of, you know, we're the house band for. So we have, you know, Helen Sung just canceled. She's a great young jazz piano player. But the train back, she just got a gig teaching jazz piano at Berklee School of Music.
Good for her.
So she's not going to be able to make it back in time. So we're losing Helen. But we still have Machan, who sang with us on our East album, and you know who sang with Pink Floyd and sang with us on our East album. She's coming down to sing, and
wonderful.
We have Kaoru Watanabe, who's going to play Japanese bamboo flute and percussion. And there's an amazing percussion group that tours the world called Kodo, and they're enormous everywhere. He is one of the representatives of Kodo, but he is also a trained jazz saxophone player.
He
went to Juilliard, you know. So he's coming down and playing. We have Vinks. Do you know who Vinks is?
Yes,
Vinks,
I sure do.
He toured with Sting and things like. Vinks he's coming down tomorrow. And in fact, Vinks is doing dates. He's doing the Birchmere with us the day before we did the Rams Head. But then he has to go to Europe, so he can't do a Ramshead. So we'll bring him to Ramshead next time. But for Ramshead, Ramshead were the debut and departure, the new album. That's gonna be our.
Oh, are you really?
Yeah. Before we did Legacy, and before we did the album, before that Little Tokyo, we played all the new music at the Ramshead. Like I say, because after each song, we go, well, what do you think? It's like that, and we get immediately. We start talking to you. And, you know, it's such a great. It's a fun place, right? I mean, it's got the whole a brew pub right next door. You know, and Annapolis, you couldn't be in a more charming environment.
That's right.
Know? I mean, it's such a great hang. I mean, we so look forward to it, and so we're gonna. There are songs that we've never played live, because when you record, you're not really playing live.
That's right.
And a lot of times, people are overdubbing individually. Legacy was one of the few albums that was a live record.
And I love the idea that you decided to re-record each of the tracks because, you know, I was going back through the 11 songs, and I'm going, okay, now this one... That was from Go, and then there was from one from another place, and then there's another one from Providence in 1992. It was so cool that you did each of them anew.
Well, what we decided to do is you know, we thought, oh, it's 30 years, we should do some kind of, we don't want to say best of, because I don't know really what that means, but some kind of collection.
Right.
And then when we put it on the website, you know, we got so much feedback of what should be on it that we narrowed it down to 37 tunes. You know, because we have over 200 recorded songs, right?
I so know. It's gosh, 15 CDs, right? 15 albums at least.
22. But the departure's at 22nd. We'll do it by periods. Subdivide three periods, and so this is period one, and so ultimately we're going to take each period and revisit the period.
Okay, so the first 10 years were revisited with Legacy, so now you'll proceed from there.
Right, eventually, but we were really itching to do new music, and so that's what Departure is, and Departure has, I think some of our best work on this new project, Departure.
And it
again runs the gamut from I wrote a song that it's a jazz blues and 6/8 for Japan called Blues for Sendai, and it's going to be for tomorrow night. Everyone's jamming on it. Things are jamming on it. Helen was going to, but we're having other people sit in. A guitar player friend who people know, but I can't name because he's on a contract with somebody else. But he's sitting in. David Henry Wong, who wrote what was voted the best American player of the last half century. He wrote M. Butterfly. He grew up in a musical family as a jazz violinist. So he's actually coming and bringing. He's got a new play opening on Broadway in October. Called Chinglish, but he's been practicing, and he's coming in, and he's playing jazz violin on a couple of tunes with us.
Wonderful.
For Ramsat, it's our departure debut. In fact, we're doing something kind of strange. What we're going to do is the record will not be completed, the physical record won't be completed till the end of October. It won't be out. The people are going to be able to download it from our website right about the beginning of October.
That'll be just in time for my birthday on the 16th. Thank you ahead of time.
Oh, great. So you're right on the cusp of a Scorpio. Okay. I'm an October person. So, okay, my birthday's on October, too. So bottom line, we're bringing the CD sleeve. No CD. We're bringing the sleeve, and we're asking people to just fill a little form. So give us their email address. We'll email them when our new CD is available, so they can download it from our website or from our Facebook, and they'll have the sleeve. But then because when you download a CD, then you just have the CD. But we'll have the sleeve at the show, and then we'll happily autograph the sleeve. So when they download it, they'll have a complete little package.
Hot. Yeah. I love that idea.
We're giving the sleeve for free. And then not only that, but they're going to get a discount on the download. So I can't really say the price, but it's way, way under $10. And they'll have the sleeve.
That is so cool.
We owe it to our friends there. So we literally got sleeves printed up just for this little run. Just to give away, because we feel like we're late and people are looking for that new project, and so we can go part way, and that's what we intend to do. But yeah, Departure's a lot of fun. We actually we haven't had a full on Taiko solo on an album since our third album.
And Choji's going to be on all over this.
Yeah, Shoji's gonna. On Departure, he's gonna. He does this thing with throat singing and a full blown taiko solo with he and Danny, and then a whole brace of new tunes. Like I said, Blues for Sendai. That it's much more Danny a jazz drummer's kind of thing. But we like to think it's pretty cool. Junie Kimo wrote a song called Have You Ever Wondered, that is just. I think it's going to be one of our. Like what we call our own little personal classics, because it is just what it is. And on the recorded version, sadly he's not with us, but on the recorded version, Tetsu Nakamura is playing harmonica. Tetsu is best known for being the harmonica player for War for the last 15 years.
Holy smoke. Oh, that's
so
exciting.
Yeah, Departure is a really, really, really interesting project. And it's a little more fun. I wrote a song called Koto Cruz that June plays one of our most jamming Koto solos ever on. It has a almost 3-minute long Koto solo at the end of the song. And it's just insane. She just goes, it's classic. And, since we left our label, it was an option year, and we left, we thought, record companies really can't help you right now, and really now's the time for us to become part of, we're trying to form arts alliances with other artists to make music more accessible.
I think that's wonderful.
Also to bump up music education. I know in Chicago, next year we've already slated in the month of September a whole bunch of high school music workshops.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, you know, we're going to pass along, you know, the practical of doing music, not just the theoretical, but the practical. Yeah, and we're doing, you know, so when we do concerts in Chicago, that in conjunction with that, and we're trying to have a special thing so the kids can come out so they can see the whole process from, you know, generating an idea, playing the instruments, and then having a performance. So it's all sort of like giving back in a way, you know. But
And you'll have that on your website.
Absolutely.
You'll have the information on your website.
And on our Facebook, you know, which and our Facebook page.
Oh, good.
And June has a Facebook page.
Oh, good.
Yeah, June's really embarrassed about it because she said, June is a very shy person. But she's very strong-willed, but she's very shy. But she's got a really cool Facebook page. And you know, it's as I said, it's time to grow the community. So that's what we're
doing. Yes, that's right. That's right. And here you are. Do you realize that we're over an hour? Is that unbelievable to you? I love to hear No, it's so exciting to hear you. You have been one of the more unique human beings on this show or any show I've done because you took the ball and, Dan, you ran with it.
I love it.
Don't be at all. I wanted to hear soup to nuts.
I started saying, as I said, I told stories I've never told. I can't believe I said those things.
That is so wonderful because that's exactly what people want to hear, the backbone of this group that has touched them for so long. There is healing involved in this, Dan, and people want to know the core of what it is that have made them healed through the years. You did such a phenomenal job. God bless you. I'm going to see you for the early show on Saturday.
Fabulous. I'm so excited.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, I don't even know at this particular juncture because I don't even want to let you go. But I know that you have to go, and it's going to be wonderful. This relief effort for Japan at BB King's Times Square tomorrow. You've got Scholars in Boston. You've got Birchmere in Alexandria. You've got the Pinnacle Ram's Head where you're going to debut some of your new creations. What a fabulous week!
Yeah, I think we're going to play a little over half of Departure at Rams. There's a couple of things we're not done yet with. One of them, Smiling Jack, who I wrote for my dad, who just passed. His name is Jack, and everyone said he had the best smile. It's very esoteric because it's a song I wrote from a period of music that I really liked in the 70s, and there was a band called Traffic with Steve Winwood.
Yes.
That, you know, they did the Low Spark, High Heel Boys and stuff
like
that.
Oh, yeah.
That I was like, I love. And there was another B3 band, Brian Auger and Trinity. And
one of my favorites.
Rock and Soul. Well, Smiling Jack is a rock and soul. And Kimo was known as the best B3 player ever in Hawaii. And he plays some scary B3.
Oh, man.
Yeah, so it's all. And then we did this another song that we're not ready to perform at First Nation, where Kimo plays in this really rock setting. He plays an amazing McCoy Tyner piano solo that is just spooky. It's just, and the song is just ripping.
So
fun because, you know, without a label to say yay or nay, you know, we figure with 30 years of doing this, we ought to be able to call our own shots, right? So that's
What did you say a long time ago when you were forming your three tenets for why this band was to be? One of those tenets is you have to agree that there are no barriers to create.
That's right.
There you go. You're following your own tenet.
It's been an honor to talk to you. I hope we get to do this again.
Oh, I hope so, too. And bless your efforts for all that you intend to do, because I can tell from the excitement in your voice, this is a new page that you're turning, and everything will be there at your website, so people will feel part of a real community. Thank you for that.
Well, what it allows us to do is give things away, too, because when you're with a label, you can't give things away.
That's right.
You have to get a release for everything. So again, we're going to try to make everything, you know, as long as we don't lose money on it, things are going to get a lot less expensive. And we're going to do some in the future. I don't know if I should say. Okay.
Uh-oh.
But we're going to do a series called The Sessions. And I mentioned earlier all these people that we knew.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to do things with different artists where it's just three songs. And there's going to be where people can download it or a lot of these things they can hear, you know, us, and sometimes live, you know, with people that they love playing with us.
That's beautiful.
You know, like, yeah, and I can't say the names that I've already said, but people like that, and everyone's psyched to do it, and it's a kind of liberation of artist to artist, and just taking the journey.
Those are the kind of things
we're building on the website now.
And here we are. We're getting to the end of 2011, so 2012 is going to be magnificent. Good for you. Woo! I'm excited.
Maybe we can do one live on your show. We can do a tie-in, and we can just do a live session.
You know what? We'll have to talk about that. It's already out there. You've already spoken it, so it's going to come into existence.
Yeah, I'm absolutely serious because we came into this thinking music is something that is shared.
That's right. That's right. And if music is not shared, which is one of the greatest gifts that God has ever given people, what
right.
is there to be shared? This is the very
right.
core of why music is. So
absolutely.
Anything that I can do to make sure that your efforts are enhanced, I'll do it for you, Dan Kuramoto.
Well, thank you very much, Trish. And thank all who listen and communicate with you because we're all part of that same community.
That's right. That's right. And we'll see you soar, and we'll see some creations come out of Hiroshima that we have not seen before. It's like you're picking up a second wind. This is amazing.
Absolutely. That's exactly it. So we're very excited.
Oh, good for you. Well, thank you for joining me and spending so much time, Dan, and we'll see you Saturday at Ram's Head. And tell everyone I said hello, and please give June a special hug. I revere her, and I cannot wait to touch her.
Thank you so much, and blessing and peace to all.
Thank you very much, Dan.
Take care.
We'll see you.
Look forward to see you in a couple of days.
Yes, yes, and be safe in your travels.
Thank you. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
God bless. Oh, mercy. Yes. Mercy. Full heavens. I just have to say that was one of the more glorious times that I've ever had on the radio. It really is. And I have to thank Dan Kuramoto so much from Hiroshima for spending all this time and to give us the backbone of the group. I'm going to close out the show. Here it is, way over. I'm closing out the show with a tune that struck a chord when it first came out so many years ago from East, certainly one of my favorite Hiroshima tunes. And the story of the song is just so wonderful that I need to play it for you because even though there are some sad elements in the story involved, the song itself gives people such hope and such peace and looking forward as opposed to backward. This is Thousand Cranes on Hybrid Jazz from Trish Hennessy. Have a wonderful, wonderful evening, day, night, and we'll talk to you next time. I'll just close out the show this way. God bless you. We'll see you on Thursday with Frederique Yanet.